have a very special guest with me today, whom I go way back with to my undergraduate days at Eastern Michigan University. I have Lieutenant Colonel Adrian Massey with me today of the United States Army. And so, you know, I'm going to do him some definite respect and thank him for his service outright. And I want to share a little bit about his journey and his bio. But I think through this conversation, you'll definitely get to know what kind of person and human being he is. And this is probably just the tip of the iceberg of it. Adrian Massey is a Lieutenant Colonel in the United States Army. He was born in Detroit and raised in Inkster, Michigan. Upon graduation from Eastern Michigan University, EMU as we call it, in 2002, he commissioned as a second lieutenant in the U.S. Army. While attending EMU, he studied abroad at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. He also holds his master's degree in information technology management, and lastly, a diploma from United States Army Command in General Staff College Class 1401. Adrian has served in the U.S. Army for nearly 17 years and lived in Europe 8 years of his adult life, served in prestigious units such as the 82nd Airborne Division at Fort Bragg in North Carolina, and the 2nd Cavalry Regiment in Belzig, Germany. Adrian was deployed in Iraq for Operation Iraq Freedom, the third phase, and then Operation Iraq Freedom through 07-09 as the company commander providing communication for over 4,000 infantrymen throughout Baghdad. He was awarded the Bronze Star Medal for excellence in combat. Currently, Adrian's deployed in Kuwait for 12 months. He is a published author of a collection of poetry. The book is entitled A Soldier's Poetic Response, A Slice of His Life. I'll put the link so you can find out where to get his book, because y'all better do that, whoever's listening. You're a cigar-smoking, bourbon enthusiast, foodie. From the looks of it on your Instagram, a pretty badass chef. Traveler and lover of life. You know, I cannot thank you enough for making the time to talk to me today. I know you're back home, and so I do not take it lightly that you're sharing your time and your space with the listeners and myself to have this conversation. So thank you, and thank you for supporting this podcast as well and being on it.
That's a mouthful. That's a lot right there. But I'm beyond grateful, and just my hat's off to you just for doing life's work and getting after it, like in ways that help people and trying to create that kind of space. And
Do it alone, right?
Yeah, seriously, no. We 100% everybody's in this thing together, and so the opportunity to share my story and just kind of jump into that kind of stuff is just beautiful. And I'm humbled by the opportunity to be able to do that, for sure.
Same here. And you know, when I started this podcast, and I think I was sharing with you before we started recording that, you know, listen to the Joe Rogan podcast. He was interviewing David Goggins, who's, you know, a military man himself. And he said, I'm looking for those uncommon people to help me grow. And so I feel like for some reason, I would just felt called to reach out to you. There's something about your energy and who you are and your story and what you share that I felt like needed to be in this space, needed to be, you know, put out to listeners now to somebody, because there's definitely somebody going to be listening that needs to hear what you're going to say today. So, and I think they'll be surprised, right? You're a highly decorated officer, but you're also a very deep and eloquent writer. You know, I mean, your words are very powerful. Yeah.
I appreciate that.
And then I read that you wrote the majority of your first book during your first deployment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or all of it.
I mean, that was most of it, like 3/4 of it. I mean, it was pure therapy during that time. It was just necessary to help me kind of, And what I couldn't capture in pictures, just to be able to capture in word pictures, essentially, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's deep. It's deep. So let's backtrack. How did you get, and I don't know if you want to start, because you're from Michigan. I'm from Michigan originally. Yeah. So, I mean, Eastern Michigan for me was just the choice I was going to go to. But graduating and then deciding to enlist in the Army.
So...
Is there a family history?
Yeah. So yes and no, right? And so I'm the first officer in my family. Almost all my aunts and uncles have served in some capacity for a couple of years, right? But for me, it was just straight up out of a need. And so I'm gonna just jump right in on just painting some context, right? my family is complicated, like all families, right? Mm-hmm. And so I grew up with single mom, and my mom was my first example of grit, right? And
yep, just like my mom. Yep.
Perseverance and hustle and ability to just like get up and grind every day. And she was driven by making sure my younger brother and I, it's just two of us, had this space to be able to be safe, be able to grow, and just be what we wanted to be, yeah. Right? And so, yep. and for her, that was going to come by any means necessary. And so my mom was a bartender at Metro Detroit Airport, and since she was pregnant with me, still is, right? Still works there.
Wow.
And my father, her and my father did get married, and they were married for about 5 years. And my dad was a straight up street dude. And so, think about Inkster in Detroit during Reagan era time, right? Mm-hmm. So you got the auto industry booming like crazy, Reagan era, you know, drugs hitting the streets. So Inkster was like a instant zombie land, while simultaneously, like the auto industry, which was booming, had all these blue collar folks and like all my friends' parents making like $100,000 a
that
year.
That was the job. You know, getting a factory job was the thing in Michigan during that time. Right. Yeah.
So like,
I mean, that was a proud job to have too. Yeah,
big time, right? Yeah. And so that shaped a lot of like how people hustled, moved, everything, right? Everything orbited around that in that time period. At the same time, I think the younger people, you know, especially younger black folks in Inkster, when you grew up seeing, you know, that's when crack hit the streets, right?
Mm-hmm.
My father got involved in that. A lot of my aunts and uncles were somewhat involved in that on my pop side. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, you know, I remember from my mom, it was like, you know, this kind of tug of war of, hey, you know, I got all of these influences going on, you know, how do I keep these boys safe and that kind of thing. So we moved a few times, and you know, I was kind of raised by a village in a lot of ways.
What ages were you, like the earliest memories, like you remember like that struggle and so seeing all that around you? What any ages that you?
Yeah, for me, honestly, I remember playing at my grandmother's house. She lived off a street called Kitch in Inkster. And my other grandmother lived off the parallel street, which was Meadowdale. And like literally you'd be playing there. I mean, me and my cousins playing in the yard, you picking up dope needles, like buried in the dirt. You walk past some cars, you see people smoking crack right in the backseat of cars. Like, I mean, it was like straight up apocalypse zombie. Like,
did you all know what was going on? Was it like?
Yes and no, right? Because nobody really wanted to talk about it. Right. That's the crazy thing, right? Because everybody's prideful and like, no, like, you know. So this is like slowly deteriorating, you know.
How old were you?
I was probably about 10 to 12 when I remember seeing that. Pretty heavily.
So, you know, so pretty influential. Be aware, like something's not right, or this is,
Yeah, absolutely. So that's kind of that trauma and that stuff that kind of shapes, you know, all of the outside influencing factors, right? So you got that kind of world going on. Then coming up through high school, watch my buddy struggle with that. And just during that time, too, I can't remember. It was like my 10th or 12th birthday. I just remember it was a birthday. It was one of those. My pops had got shot in the eye with a double barrel shotgun. Somebody knocked out the porch light, shot him in the face. My pops has a glass eye, right? And so, like, I remember going and visiting him in the hospital, and he looked like freaking, remember that movie Elephant Man?
Yeah.
Oh, that's, man. That's how my pops looked in the hospital. And, so there's that.
And that was that incident happened at your home?
That happened at his house in the city.
At his house. Okay.
Yeah. That happened at his house in the city. And we were actually supposed to link up with my dad that day And at that point, my parents were going through separation. And I remember my mom telling me, hey, we're going to go to Toys R Us, blah, blah, blah. And like, that never happened. And so instead of a trip to Toys R Us, we went to the hospital to see my old man, like, laid in the hospital, you know, shot in the face. And like,
did you live in the same town, like nearby?
So he was like 15 minutes away.
Okay.
So not far. Yeah.
So I mean, that pretty much like happened close to home. It wasn't like several cities over. It was just like the sense that this danger, this happened just, you know, right down the street. Right. Yeah, the sense of like not, I guess early on, maybe you're not conscious of it, but already like the sense of not feeling safe or having to be on high alert, having to recognize that like threat or survival is a reality around you. Yeah.
And, you know, and so, you know, how when I think back on like how those kind of crucible moments shaped me, right? When I was about 14 years old, like I was like in between 12 and 14, I was like crazy suicidal. Yeah. And I went through a significant amount of like depression and everything else. I was just angry. Right. For a number of reasons. My mom worked two jobs. My mom bust her tail. And so, like, you know, I couldn't go out and play on anybody's football team. I had to take care of my brother. You know, I had come straight home from school and, you know, had all this responsibility. And then.
Yeah. You were like your mom's partner. I mean, you were the man of the house. 100%. You were having to parent your brother because your mom was out trying to, you know, take care of you, like, you know, but it's I think out of a single parent household, it's weird how it, in psychology we call it like reparenting ourselves, but that's what ends up happening. We have we grow up having to figure out, you know, the parts that we didn't get parented because our parents are trying to survive.
And so, you know, and my mom, I mean, to this day, just hats off to her, like,
sure,
you know, just for her tenacity, right, and just toughness all the time. But so around 14, 15, two significant things happened in my life kind of simultaneously. So, and two people I met who changed my life. So my uncle Paul, Paul Green, he was a preacher at this little church out in Inkster. And he since passed away. But this guy, he was just, Paul was like religious, but not dopest heart you can ever see in any human being in terms of just pure freaking goodness. Like, I'm not super religious anymore. But when I think of somebody who actually embodied that lifestyle, that was my Uncle Paul. And so like, when I was going through my hardcore depression, that kind of thing, my mom linked me up with him, and he and I got really close. I started going to church with him. And then within about a year, the two were being there, they let me, I ended up becoming an associate minister. Like, I picked up on this stuff like so fast, right? And so I preach from 15 to about 21 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And so like traveled throughout Michigan preaching, like preached at that church out in Inkster for years and like full blown associate minister down there.
Yeah. Weren't you an Eastern as well?
In the first part of my up until I was like 21 mm-hmm. years old. Right. And so that helped shape me, right, and just kind of clean up a lot of stuff. So simultaneously, I met my mentor, and his name is Bill Gray. So funny enough, he's a clinical psychologist, and he was a school psychologist at my high school.
Yeah, I read that on your blog. That was very cool.
Yeah, so like, here Bill is, you know, walking down the hall, and Bill's this, you know, Bill's this white dude who's 30 years my senior, almost exactly 30 years my senior. And he's from Garden City. His dad was a used car salesman, and he's just one of these guys that just he is like like a blue collar street monk.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And just dynamic all the way around. And so having been influenced by the church, and then I got this mentor who I remember him coming to visit my church. So here he shows up to this poor black church out in Inkster. It's essentially what it was in hindsight, if folks are being real with themselves. And then afterwards, we have this kind of intellectual conversation that I'll never forget. He and I sit in his office back at the high school. He's like, I think it's a quote by Karl Marx, but he said, you know, have you ever heard that religion is the opiate of the poor? What's that mean to you? I'm like, ooh, damn. Right?
Damn.
and it resonated.
How old were you at that point?
I was like 15. I was like 16 years old, 16, 17 years old. Right. And so, but he kicked it in such a non-judgmental way, but it still resonated. Right. And he never worked to change that, because it was like, if this was getting you over, brother, stick with it. Right.
Amen.
Because he was all about having some type of whatever life institution you need.
Right.
To help you get over, to be geared in and be firing on all cylinders by any means necessary.
Right.
Get it. Right.
Well, it's but just like how your mom, I even wonder about that. Like, what was that moment where your mom's like, I need to link you up with Paul? Like, there was something in that moment that, like divine intervention, some kind of something that just got it in her heart where she's like, this move needs to happen. And it was just an introduction, and then boom, it like took off, you know, your path took off. But like, where, yes, like people are put on your path, you know, they say for a reason or a season or a lifetime.
Yeah.
Right. And it is to move you to that next level or to get you through that's the good stuff right there.
So here, like, okay, so now I got this kind of these worlds of, you know, religion, and then I got this intellectual mentor who also has all of these mental health tools, right? Mm-hmm. He's a clinical psychologist, and I didn't really get that until I was older, right? mm-hmm. But like, this dude was shaping me, and like, we'd go out kayaking, and he'd have me over to dinner with his family, you know, and then he's like, hey, like, and this is how I ended up getting into Eastern, right? So I used to cut hair. I started cutting hair at 12 years old. I've been working since I was 12. So I'm known for cutting everybody's hair. So I'm like, and at the time, you know, so I'm cutting hair, preaching. I'm about 16 years old, coming up, of course, in high school graduation. And Bill's like, Bill's like, so like, what are you going to do, man? Like, what's the plan? And I'm like, I got it. I think I got a plan. And so he pulls out this blue notepad. I never forget, you know, because it says, you know, William Gray, school psychologist, Wayne Memorial. That's the letter.
Yeah.
Little notepad. He pulls it and just he writes down, you know, because I told him I was going to be a barber and a preacher. So he writes down barber and preacher across the top, and then draws a line down the middle and writes, you know, benefits of a 4-year degree. Right. And just writes down like some hypothetical, you know, lifestyle benefits of the two.
Yeah.
And he turns a piece of paper around towards me. He was like, okay, check this out. If you could choose out of these two lives and these salaries and that kind of thing, which life would you choose? I'm like, I mean, it's a no brainer. I'd go to college in a heartbeat.
Right.
He's like, what the hell are you doing then? Let's get you into college. I'm like, no. And so.
So before that point, there was nobody had planned the seed, like,
no,
you go to college, like you're capable of it.
No. So I'm going I'm at this church with all these folks who are praying to Jesus and doing all this stuff. But like, ain't nobody doing stuff for this life.
Yeah.
You know, that's the catch, right? Ain't nobody doing anything for this life. Like, what are you doing for now, today? Right. Instead of praying for the next life. And, you know, and so I won't go deep down that rabbit hole, but so he gets me, so he sends me to my counselor's office, right? And so I go see the counselor. I'm like, hey, Mr. Gray told me to get some applications and fill these out with you. Why? You know, so I'm looking at going to college. I'm sitting at her seat and she's like working and she pops open this file cabinet, pulls them out, you know, and it's like, here. It's like, but I'm going to tell you straight up, I don't know why you're going to fill out any applications because you're in university material. I don't even know why.
Oh my gosh.
Right.
I kid you not. That's almost a similar experience that I had. So I look in the office, they're working, they point to a file cabinet. They're like, they're organized by state. Go for it. Right? And that was it.
Right.
Damn.
It's so just like brutal, cold blooded.
Yeah.
Oh man. I'm like, and that for me, like, you know,
where's the belief? Where's the hope? Yeah. Just a little.
Oh,
stuff.
Man.
Like, here, go for it.
I felt like I got kicked in the nuts.
Yeah.
At the time. I'm like, and I remember like being instantly emotional, right? Mm-hmm. So I go back to Bill's office. I'm like, I was like pissed with him. I felt like he set me up on purpose.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I felt like he knew something that I didn't know or whatever, right? But I blamed him in some way. But he's like, hey, forget that. He's like, I'm gonna work this thing out. So this guy. And Bill's a hustler, you know. Mm-hmm, he's Bill Gray. So he gets on the phone. He calls Eastern Michigan. He calls the administration office, and he talks to the head of administration there at EMU, and talks to him like straight up knows him. You would have thought they had a relationship. As soon as they got off the phone, I'm like, did you know that guy? I'm like, how long did you know him? He's like, nope. It's like, here's the deal. They got this program that we're gonna try to get you into. And that was that summer incentive program, SIP.
Oh, yeah. That, okay. Yep.
You know, so they only took like 50 minority students and mm-hmm. whatever. And just like 300 folks applied. So like literally, you know, stars just align. I get into Eastern, and then from there, like, you know. I just started.
So really, really stars just aligned?
Yeah, right. Yeah, you that's think? A great. No, go for it.
You know, I wonder about those spaces because I often look back too and I'm like, how the hell did I get from high school where I went through some deep shit because my dad died and I didn't know how to grieve. And it was only until like 5 years ago I looked back and realizing that teenage girl was grieving. And acting up and doing drugs and drinking and hanging out with the wrong crowd to figure out how to cope. So, you know, like, but that's where I feel like soccer saved my life because it always showed me this other life, these, you know, riding in nice cars and going to like the soccer family's houses and all this is nice. So, but I always wonder like that moment, like, how did I get from high school to college? Like that bridge. And it's insane, but I do believe like, Bill having I also had a Bill in my life that he was a Ukrainian guy in DC but went hiking and he was a canoe guy. It's so weird. But I think putting those people on your path like you know, and not in a religious sense but like a guardian angel or just someone that's meant to come in to just use
their
gifts and everything they've been through, kind of like what we're doing now, right? Yeah, like to give, pay it forward, to give it back, like, cause we're all connected, right?
And I think you gotta be willing, right? You gotta be open. There's a certain amount of openness and hunger that's gotta just be there. And I think when that meets up with, you know, the right people and you're awake to it, and then, you know, you mix that with what Angela Duckworth talks about when she talks about grit, talking about, you know, perseverance and passion, you know, when those two meet and you just combine all of that in that life gumbo, like magical shit happens. Right?
Yep.
But
at that point in life, you've already withstood so much. Right. So the grit in you was already cultivated without our awareness. That's why, you know, grit, I think, is a fascinating concept because they talk about ways to try to train it. But like it's kind of what David Goggins is doing. Like he's going out and doing like things like fighting wildfires. And he's like, there's no glory in that. He's like, no one's taking Instagram pictures. No one gives you a award for it.
Yeah.
But you're doing it to stay in the struggle, to remind myself who I am and whatnot. But no one in their comfortable, nice, you know, lives are going to go out and put themselves in some really gritty, painful shit.
I'm with you. Like, so there's that, right? And it's interesting because I think, I think that's the stuff that kind of helped shape me to, like, have that initial grit. But the experiences with the Army, to be a young African-American officer coming from where I come from, bunch of sharp kids who just came from Ivy League stuff, like, you know, and like, here I am coming from Eastern Michigan with a little bit of hustle. I got a good mentor. I got some people at home that love me. And like, you know, I studied abroad. So I've been open and I've been outside of my comfort zone before. So that those tools help me. But like that willingness to be thrown, like you said, be thrown in things that make you uncomfortable. Like, I remember, like,
your whole life in some way?
Yeah, right. And so, like, I remember, like, being, when I first got in the Army, I used to repeatedly, I even had it written down next to my bed, be comfortable being uncomfortable. Yeah. Like, you just have to be in that space. Like, you just have to be uncomfortable because that's the only way you're going to grow. It's the only way you're going to learn. So just get after it. Don't even worry about it. Even just being a leader in the Army, now leading people and playing that game, you know, I'm blessed. I'm operating at the highest point of my game, Lieutenant Colonel in the Army. Like, it's a big deal. I would have never thought, you know, I just got to the place to where I'm okay saying that out loud.
right,
without feeling guilty or weird or whatever else, right?
What was that? What's that about?
So
I can relate. I can definitely relate, but I want to hear. Yeah.
So I think it's a number of things, right?
Because what it triggers.
Like, I graduated high school 2.0. You know, got a 14 on my ACT.
Yeah.
Right. So.
Yep.
I was never confident in my academic ability. I mean, I was that kid at Eastern who'd never taken a typing class before. So, like, you know, I'm typing papers, you know, pegging away one finger at a time, you know, trying to bang out a 10-page paper. I'm just like, you go home, and like all my cousins, and, you know, these young men who don't live the way I live, or don't have, or have never, you know, so it's a little bit of that, like, survivor's guilt. And,
absolutely. You know,
and as well as mixed with, like, underdog syndrome, right? Mm-hmm. Which is crazy. Like, that creates so much damn anxiety sometimes.
Yep.
Oh, man.
I feel you. I mean, I remember, being at college, and I didn't know anything about anything. So I thought you had to pay for orientation. I didn't know it gets charged to your student account. So I didn't go to orientation because, like, I don't have the $100 for it. So I just pull up and, you know, move in the dorms. And, like, everybody knows what they're doing and where they're, because they all went to orientation. So you somewhat seem like you know what you're doing, especially, you know. But, you know, once I settled in a little bit, I would go home on weekends and do my laundry and all that because it's the same money and a budget. But I remember being in class and just being so thankful because I go home and my mom lives in a trailer and they're still working in a factory. And, you know, my sisters are, you know, still teenage mothers, or my niece and nephews are there. And I love my niece and nephews because they just help me de-stress. I could just go home and feel that love and comfort. But I just remember thanking God, like, man, I'm glad I'm in this classroom. And not back home, you know, at the factory. Because in the summer, I did work in the factory. I got in some trouble, needed to pay some tickets. And so I had to get a job.
Right.
And I needed to save for books and whatnot because, again, screwed up some financial aid paperwork. And I remember being in that factory job working in cutting vinyl off of the doors because, you know, the automotive industry still was a little bit thriving then. And cutting vinyl. And I remember, like, I get to, after this couple months, I get to go back to school and my mom and my sisters don't, you know, they're still going to be waking up 5 a.m, driving out to Manchester, coming back, you know, the whole hustle. And I was like, man, I'm just so grateful. And I think that's the other piece, right? Like, when you get to this other space, like, the gratitude that, because life could look very different, you know?
Listen, I'm so grateful. It's unreal. Like, it's bananas sometimes, right? when you think of it.
Even in the hard shit you saw, because reading your blog, I think if anybody, because it sounds like you didn't keep it going for a long time, but even some of those posts are just really eye-opening about, you know, you were talking about, you know, I think it was a May 9th post in 2008 about the four rockets that had hit, and you were, you know, setting up communications and whatnot. And you said, come to find out, the first rocket landed 50 feet from when you were sitting. And you said, it's a gamble. You never know what's next. You say those silent prayers and hope for the best. You try your best to take care of one another, but the first thing you learn is that life goes fast, especially in war. And I'm thinking, like, man, and you still have the most positive and the gratitude you admit after going through that. You know?
Even in this space, I mean, every day, man, it just got me a little emotional.
I'm right there with you, man. Right there with you.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
But I mean, on the soldier side of the house, we're all just young Americans. Like, it's, and so the Army is a lot like it's real life, right? And so it's this microcosm of just like all of America in one organization, right? And so even in that, so you got the enlisted side, which can be, you know, very tough. You come in as a private, you work your way up, that kind of thing. Then you got the officer side, which is my world, which can be privileged, but comes with its own, you know, level of responsibility. But knowing the path that I have come from, this reality and this military reality, I even feel guilty about that sometimes, right?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's a certain amount of privilege that I get in this in this space too. But you know, just reading, listening to you read that a little bit, just like every day, all the young people and all the young soldiers I get to serve with and have to serve with, whatever, man, they just touch me. Like, we're just souls out here, people out here, bodies, brains, spirit, depth, trying to figure out, you know, what it is you want out of this thing. What's it mean to you every day? And like, to be in a space to where that becomes so fragile, like, literally, like, status, none of that shit matters anymore.
Right.
Nothing matters. Like, you're just there. This is raw as it gets. And and being able to see, you know, and really think about, who the hell am I? What do I want out of this thing? What am I going to, if I make it back home, you know, why not make it back home? What's what's that going to look like? And which I still don't know, right? I still don't know what I want to do when I grow up. I mean, I got 3 years, like I told you before, and I'll retire, you know, but it's been interesting. So being in Kuwait now, not in a volatile environment. Traveled to some from time to time. I still visit Iraq, which has changed so much since, you know, from what I remember. You know, I have the opportunity to go to Afghanistan when I get back. And so everything I do now impacts the fight. Right. And so from a larger strategic level, so I provide strategic communications to the warfighter all throughout Southwest Asia. And so, you know, having the opportunity to go away and come back.
Yeah.
Like, I'm here, for, you know, home for 2 weeks now. And just like, you know, in a lot of ways, you become quite institutionalized in those moments, like deeply institutionalized. Right. And then you experience this kind of rawness of just like traveling. And I mean, the last time I was in a combat environment, I mean, I was there for 15 months and literally there was not a day where I was not shot at, blown up, rocketed in like some capacity. Right. In some capacity every single day, every day. Then you come back home. And then you're in this new space again, and you look around, the world's moving, you sit in restaurants, folks is drinking, eating, happy, no stress, doesn't seem that way, right? And then like, you feel like you're like in a movie or something, and all this shit's happening around you, and it's like, why the fuck are you guys so happy? It's a lot of shit going on all around the world, right? And so, but then you learn a lot about yourself at the same time, and then you start asking deeper questions about you. You know, what's, am I okay? You know, what have I learned from this? And it's just, it's super complex to come in and out, So it's my like third time, you know, being away for a significant amount of time, for over a year, right? And so
just so having said all that, real quick.
Yeah, go for it. Yeah.
Why then, in your mind, what makes it so hard to let go of that quote unquote like survivor's guilt? Because it's like, man, you've really paid your dues and then some to own and be proud of navigating everything you did to get to this point in your life.
Yeah.
To really own surviving all of that, but then even developing the leadership. Because this is, I feel like, the flip side of grit is the genius. Like every single pain has created something into you that's helped you get to, you know, the peak, the high point.
But it sounds like
we get guilty and we feel guilty for the high points. I've definitely felt it. You know, I mean, sometimes my family, they're like, oh, don't treat me like one of your clients, or, oh, because you're educated, or you're talking educated. And it's really hurtful because, you know, it's like, man, this is a path and a journey that really I had to chart all on my own, which I think essentially every human being on this earth is charting their own path. But some people have a better blueprint than others. And some people are just starting from scratch or like are gritty moments. Like, and have to say, like, how is that preparing me for something I have no idea of what's ahead, whether it's it's being a first generation college student, whether it's for me how to freaking have a healthy relationship with a man, you know, because of my absent father. And you know, it's like all
that's a whole nother story, man.
Yeah, that is, but yeah, I definitely had to work on being able to say, you know what, and that guilt coming up are punishing me for my success or my survival or for what? What's it trying to do? My dues. I've went through some shit, and that's kind of another reason why I think the space is so important. You know, that we remind ourselves of our story. Like, damn, yeah.
I just kind of had an epiphany. Like, I think that's what impacts me deciding, like, how do I use now all of this experience in life to like launch the next part of my life. Like, am I doing more stuff like this? Am I sharing my story? Like I think sometimes even in this moment, right? Like what's special about me to put it on a podcast and have other people hear it?
Everything.
Really.
Right? Your being, everything. Yeah.
But like that's one of those feelings, right? And so like, so I think not getting trapped in that space. Now it's like you've gone through all of this. Now launch it. Like you've gone through all of this for a reason. Like, you know, and it's complicated stuff sometimes. Or is it that complicated? Maybe it's not that complicated.
What's complicated for you?
The willingness to just for real to extend myself and be my best and absolute self outside of this. Because I don't think I need to do a job when I finish the Army here. Mm-hmm. Like, I got all of these skills now. Like, go do life with people. Go help some other folks. Like, right? But then that puts you in a space to where, like, you have to almost package your story in a way. Right?
Oh, like the branding kind of thing. Where do I start? Yeah. I've reinvented myself and my quote unquote website so many times. I can help you along with that. But I think it's tough to do because we constantly evolve and change.
Yeah.
You know? And so I think it is hard to say, like, how do I just package this up? And I even with this podcast, I'm like, should I have a format? Should I do this and that? And I'm like, no, I'm just going to do what I feel like feels right in this space and share it with someone else and have a conversation, because I think that's just my style. If you meet me in person, it's going to be the same way, right? It's going to be authentic. Yeah. But I think creating a space. So let me remind you, I'm going to go back to your blog. You posted something on June 15th, 2008, titled Life Goes On. And you said, I don't know if you remember this post, but you said, as this life goes on, I've got responsibility to be better, to work harder and attempt to influence the world around me the best I know how. My desires are seeming too big for my skin. My love outstretches my capability, and I am a participant of this life that is just going on.
Wow.
And I'm like, my mind is blown. My desires are seemingly too big for my skin. My love outstretches my capability, and I am a participant of this life that is just going on.
That's heavy for me right now.
Yeah, I feel like to feel like there is this deep desire to, yes, want to help people, want to connect, and that it's almost just like you said, it's not, I don't think it's too big for your skin. It's just wanting to come out, right?
Yeah.
Building. It's like birthing, right? Where it's just, yeah. It's almost time to come out, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Give me some.
I mean,
stuff
you are
about.
Such an eloquent writer, though. I think your words are very powerful. I think about how hard lately this has been on my mind, how hard it is, and how, you know, no matter how many people I talk to with a gritty story, and I'm not saying I need to talk to people who have been through the worst of the worst, but I feel like sometimes we don't share our story, and I didn't share my story for a lot of times because I felt the shame of it. I felt ashamed to be poor, to know what real food stamps look like, not the EBT card,
right.
Free lunches, or, you know, Salvation Army used to, deliver toys to our door every Christmas for a long time. You know, like I felt ashamed of those things and never wanted to own my story and never felt, like worthy enough. Like, what is so special from me? Because, you know, the system told me I was a burden or like I was charity. Right. So but then there's this other side that my mom working so hard, even in her best efforts to work so hard, we still needed assistance. You know, right. And so being a product of that, I just feel like it's that shame or feeling like I couldn't own the other side of that story has made it hard. And I think it's only recently where I'm giving myself permission to do that in my own way, because I also feel like I knew from when I started this journey in psychology, I'm like, OK, so I want to be a psychologist, but that's not who I am. So it'll be the instrument. And I've started thinking about myself more in that human being terms. Like that's an instrument. That's a tool that helps me reach certain people. It's got certain responsibilities. And that's one part of what I do or how it channels out of me. But also what's, you know, owning my story is part of what's going to make that the best channel it is. And, I think about you and how your leadership, for even African American men in the army aspiring or hitting the barriers to feel like, can they continue to move through the ranks, you know, be a lieutenant colonel. And there you are showing them that it's possible.
Yeah.
You know, without even them knowing it probably, you know, there's that quote, you may be one person to the world, but the world to one person. I don't know that you always know how many people you have inspired or impacted just by being in their presence.
Yeah,
but I do believe that there. Yeah. I mean, just like you are a minister, right? I mean, challenge for a lot of us to fully own our greatness or fully own like all we've gone through is a good thing. Even the shitty decisions I look back on, I'm like, what the heck was going on with me? But something,
It takes some maturity and wisdom for sure. And like being able to be, you know, just reflective and like really learn
humble
from your experience, right? And be humble. Yeah.
You mentioned earlier. And what about that faith piece? So, because you mentioned earlier that, you know, you said you're not as religious anymore. How has that shifted or evolved, or how has your spirituality changed? Was it, you know, stepping out of the ministry role?
So I think it started before that. I think one of the big things for me, at this point, I've traveled to so many countries and been to so many like real poor places, you know, and have seen some pretty gritty shit. Mm-hmm. Right. On everything from kind of, you know, poverty around the world to, you know, and been in Baghdad and like you know, being in very shitty parts of Iraq, the pain of just people and just seeing, I mean, so many of my friends struggle with PTSD kind of stuff, and behaviors and all of that stuff. And just like to think of God in a way that like I thought of him before coming up under, you know, in a Pentecostal church. It's just unfathomable for me now to ever see it the same way. Like I still, I'm a believer in some being, and I believe that in a lot of ways, it's like, I mean, just the fundamentals of good living and just love and just working hard at that, like how important that is. I think religion is so far away from that for me. No matter how I experience it, I just, I see it in such an often negative light because people get away from the fundamentals of, from the fundamentals of good living and just love, period. Like, that bothers me, right? It's 'cause you got to do all this other stuff first, right? You got to have all this ceremonial, ritualistic, religion type stuff and like put the love first,
right?
You know, put the good living first. You know, I'm super attracted to Buddhists put that in the forefront of their philosophy, right?
Oh my God, you read my mind. I was just thinking about thinking about that.
You know, you talk about right speech, you know,
right
thinking, you know, right action. Like those things mean something. Like that's the stuff to me where it really counts. And and that's what has the most, that's what makes the most difference in the world, right? Not going and sitting on somebody's hard pew, paying some, you know, some tithes and offerings every week, and then you go out, you know, flicking people off because you got road rage, you're being a bitch at work because you can. Like, you know what I mean? It's like,
living, where are you living out the word? Where is it actually?
And that's that.
But just, it's interesting, because you ever see, you know, Buddhists asking for for money, you know? And it's interesting. During in college, I actually went, I used to go to Word of Faith up in Detroit when I was, I used to go to Word of Faith all the time. That shifted. So, you know, that shifted. But what I really got from it that I appreciated was the psychology of it. And also where they're like, okay, I'm going to show you three places in the scripture where it's boom, boom, boom. So I feel like now, even when I have students that I work with or people that I work with that are Christian, I can speak the language. I know I can reference where they're coming from. And I think it's, that's part of it. Like, I don't have to believe what you believe to try to understand and connect how you're thinking about the world or what it gets filtered through, right? But I absolutely believe about the Buddhist, because I what I love is like the whole, like, we are Buddha, like Buddha resides in us, which I think is partly like with Christianity, what's gotten lost is like the embody, living out Jesus, living out this Christ consciousness, you know, through love and kindness and right words and right action, which I think is pretty simple. I don't think
it's crazy simple, right? It is.
It is.
And the other two things to me that stand out with the Buddhists is, you know, this idea of impermanence, right? And that nothing's permanent and that everything's ever changing. And then the other concept is the one of, you know, of attachment, like let it go. All of it. Right? Let it go. I mean, you combine those two philosophies with hey, I'm going to treat people right. I'm going to try to think the right thoughts. You know, I'm going to try to practice the right actions and say the right things. Like, that's pretty powerful living, just plain and simple, without having to do all the other shenanigans, right?
I mean, so, you know that, you know, there's that, there's a scripture, they say it like, you know, work as if you're working for Jesus and kind of do it with that mentality, which I like, you know, I used to like that because you unattached to the outcome and you thought about the process. How do I do this with some meaning and some purpose, whether it's stocking shelves, whether it's cutting vinyl, whether it's cutting hair, like how do I do this with that presence, right?
Yeah.
So there's a Zen saying, you know, before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water.
Wow.
And I feel like profound, because this idea that we should be different after we've gotten the wisdom or the shift or the perspective. It's like, no, we still carry on. We still do the work. We still help people. We still be kind. So because we're, you know, enlightened or have this great wisdom or knowledge doesn't mean we just get kicked back and people are going to treat us all great. It's like, no, you still got to work.
Right.
You got to chop wood. Like, you still got to carry water.
Like,
right?
That doesn't change.
You still
got to
cut hair.
You're still
just
here,
like,
man.
Bill, the most highly, he's probably a spiritual master walking on earth in the halls of a high school. Just guiding and like you said, you know, what did you call him? Called him something like a...
he's like a blue collar monk or something like that.
There you go. Yeah.
Blue collar street monk. Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
There it is. He's That's still funny. Chopping wood, carrying water after he's, you know, the awakening. And so, yeah, I love that stuff, because I feel like that's also helps. I think when we get in those, you know, with what I like about the Buddhist, and I think if we can filter it through other religions or spiritualities, I think it's there. We're all essentially saying the same thing. But to unattach, even, you know, to what story is creating the guilt? What story is creating that suffering? Because we're not born with guilt. Guilt is a socially derived emotion.
Right.
So, you know, I think when we think of, that's why I preach emotion management and knowing thyself and really knowing our patterns, because I think even then there's a way to say I can unattach from this because I'm right here, right now. You're talking to another human being and sharing space, talking about life, all that stuff. Just being here and now, because nothing else exists essentially, other than the moment, the present moment, right?
So that I learned so much from that attachment piece. I mean, being a soldier, right? So now I'm home with my family. I'm around all my stuff, what I believe to be some of my stuff, right? But like, I have to literally detach from this, the physical stuff, and the emotional stuff,
too,
at the same time, like almost compartmentalize it in some ways. And so that philosophy helps me kind of carry on tremendously, because you have to detach. It's just, it is what it is. Like, you know, you get caught up hanging on too much of, you know, I need to be around my family. I need to be home. I need to be, you know, have this and that.
Yep.
Like, you can't focus. You can't work. Like,
nope.
You got to figure out how to let all that shit go to be effective.
Right. Especially when you're in survival situations, like truly the you have to focus with everything, because it's based on life and death, or you just have to be hyper aware of your surroundings. And you know, obviously, you know, I'm not a soldier and would not definitely can't speak on your experience, but I think about how zoning in and being present really does like take us out of being hijacked by an attachment. It's hard, you know, but I think of, I don't know if you really compartmentalize, I would say you've just adapted. You know, I think you're a human being that's adapted and had to understand, because you've 17 years, 18 years in, you know, the military. I mean, you're pretty much a master of that institute. You know that so well, you know. So to say, like, you've had to learn how to adapt in this institution, this system, which, I think that's the genius. That, you know, they could have told you on day one, but to say, you know, 18 years later, this is who I've become. I mean, that's powerful stuff.
Yeah.
You know, finding out how do you do that? Like, I think that's essentially all of our journeys. Like, how do we master ourselves enough to be present in this moment, to not get hijacked? But it's hard, because I can only imagine what it would be like to, I mean, it's hard for me to drop my son off at daycare. I can't imagine leaving across the country 15 months. Seriously, I can't.
Yeah. No, I know that. I know that same feeling too.
So to honor your soul, that's the path. I mean, do you believe that we come into this world kind of choosing our paths, or fate, destiny, or, I mean, because there's, you know, this certain amount of choice we have, and then there's, you know, when we're born into this world, like, do you have any thoughts about that?
Or? Yeah, I do a little bit. I was talking to my wife about that piece recently. Like, when you think back to some of your earliest memories in, like, the spirit that you operated with as a child, right? Mm-hmm. I still feel that same, like, that kind of, I think, depth that is seemingly there for me. I felt that same depth, like, as a child, like, around these adult parents of mine.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And so, like, part of me feels like, yeah, there's some physical choices that'll take you some different paths, but like that grit is baked in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm a believer in that. And
so, do you think we choose that before we're born?
I do.
Yeah.
I think so.
I believe that too. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember in undergrad, I don't know where I heard the story, but maybe it was in church. Who knows? But they're like, you know, say before you came into this earth, you were having a conversation with God and you were telling God or goddess, mother earth, divine spirit, whatever you choose to call that being, who you want, like, what kind of person do you want to be when you're on earth? And then you say, you know, I want to be kind. I want to be this. I want to be that. And they check back and say, are you sure? And, you know, you're like, yeah, God, that's who I want to be. And I'm like, all right. And so then you go down on earth and they create the crucible, the circumstances, the situation to create being a kind person, compassionate, empathetic, strong, gritty, loving, caring. And I think about how do we get through all the shit that we've gone through and still not have a hardened soul?
Right.
And still not harden your heart. Like, there's times where I've tried to, but it's like, that's just not in my nature. Like, as much as I can't be that, but I know people who have. My oldest sister struggles with that, you know, she can close up real quick. But we've, you know, somewhat lived the same life, but we're just on different soul paths. And so, you know, I like you said, it's definitely, I feel like, is baked in, but I also think it's for our evolution, you know, spiritually evolve and grow. That's deep. So thank you for that. I didn't think we were going to go there.
Yeah, right.
That's good stuff.
No, I appreciate you.
No, I appreciate you too. Do you remember there's a poem that you wrote on clarity and happiness?
No.
Okay, because it's kind of hanging out right here. I feel weird reading your poetry because I feel like you should read it, but...
No, I like this. I like this better.
Yeah, I think because it kind of speaks to what we were just talking about, but that you wrote this several years ago. It's clarity and happiness. It says, finally, elusiveness gives away to clarity with a crystal-like clearness. I am sitting between birth and death. The only thing that is permanent is change itself. There is nothing that we can rely on upon for our happiness, only the center of our souls.
I can even picture the centeredness of that. Like, it's very Buddha, you know?
Yeah.
It's just right there in the middle, you know?
Right?
Wow.
Like, this space. That's powerful. And I wonder, that was written back in 2008. But I wonder, was that awareness kind of what we're talking about now in the context that we're talking about it now, was that just kind of speaking through you without even, you know,
maybe there's no doubt. Now, I always felt that way about poetry too, tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Anything in the works for a second book or?
Yeah. I've been working on some stuff. I got stuff everywhere, just like my last book.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff on napkins, stuff on, about 30 different single pages and about 30 different notebooks. You know, I need to consolidate some things.
Yeah.
But I think it'll probably be some poetry. And I'm also thinking about writing like a pseudo, like autobiography.
Do it, man.
Yeah. So, well, yeah. So we'll see. I mean, that's kind of like a biography. Yeah. Yeah.
So, do you feel like that's what's kind of percolating for you? What's that next step? How does all of this kind of continue to channel out of you? And in what space or what does that look like?
I like the poetry, but I think when you can beautifully tell a story in words, really paint some word pictures, and we resonate with that. I mean,
yeah.
You know, and so I got a lot of stuff just brewing in me just from over the years and that I just love to share. Right.
Yeah.
Like some dark shit too. Like, and I want to see how vulnerable I can get on paper and not be ashamed of it.
Right.
Right.
Damn, that's good stuff.
Yeah. So.
Wow.
So I think the poetry that I've written, I think it's pretty vulnerable, but I feel like it's super cryptic sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. And like, I want to put it all out there, just raw and just uncut and just whatever. And know that like that's there for people to go back to and reevaluate and picture it however the hell they want and be like, fuck it. I don't care.
Do you think that'll become maybe the project after retirement or?
I'm actually there's some space to work now in the next couple of years. Yeah. So, but that will, I think I'll firm that up after retirement for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I feel you on that. I think there's a certain amount of stuff I may filter and haven't put quite out there yet. I don't know if it's that I'm not ready. It's not the space yet. But I still feel like there is more work that I continue to get inspired to do when, you know, talking to you and my last talk with Bethany and other people that I talk to. I feel like there's this preparation for it. So, and I feel like that's where the gold, Joseph Campbell says, the cave you fear to enter holds the treasure you seek. And that's one of my all-time favorite quotes, because essentially the cave we fear to enter is facing some of the darker parts of ourselves. But I also feel like that's the gold, because as deep as we can face the darker parts of ourselves, I think that's the other side of the spectrum, is that's how high we start to rise too, right?
100%.
If we only keep ourselves mediocre, that means we're only probably going mediocre depth with people. You know, we're not willing to get that vulnerable, but I feel like as vulnerable as we get with people and ourselves, that's just how high we can rise, you know?
And
I feel like that's like, the hardest thing to do.
We're here one time, you know, in this form. Like, I don't want to live like that. I want to be as vulnerable as possible.
Yeah.
You know, why not?
Why not? Yeah. it's the fear.
Right.
That's my old survival stuff, right?
Like,
it's my old survival stuff. Monitor how you look, what you say, what you do, so people will like you. And if they like you, then you have a better chance of survival. You know, but I feel you. Why not?
Hey,
I'm getting there.
But you already made it. That's the part. In a lot of ways, in terms of this.
Oh, me?
Yeah. In terms of shaping, like, you have the venue, like, you have created that between the education piece, everything, right? It, which is crazy that
crazy.
We feel like we have to like certify ourselves via this, you know, via the system to allow us that space to package it and share it in that way instead of just being able to just be raw.
Yeah.
You know,
do you think that's a person of color kind of struggle?
More so. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of feeling like you got to do more and there's kind of never enough. I think it's personal history, but it's also, thank you for that, because I need to get more into just trusting and being and that's in it and not feeling like I need to do more. I need to give more, or there's something in lack, I guess. Right.
Yeah, you got the best gut you can have. Seriously.
Thank you.
Like trust your gut, trust your own instinct. That's it. It's sharp and it got you this far.
Amen to that. Thank you. Oh man. Yeah, I feel like we could talk forever. I don't want to keep you held up for much longer. Just thank you so much. The meeting of the souls, the meeting of the minds, sharing your story. I absolutely believe someone needed to hear this, if not one person, so many other people. And I appreciate you offering that of yourself. Please continue to share your story. I mean, I'm sure later on the road we can do another talk whenever you have time. If there's something you want to speak on, or you know, you want to come together, just let me know. The space is always welcome to you.
Yeah, I appreciate you, Gloria.
Yeah, I appreciate you too, man. I'm glad this is the way we got to circle around. Thank you again. You know, you can find these episodes on iTunes, SoundCloud, the website, grittygenius@wordpress.com. Catch you later. Peace and have a good day.